All right, the Shilling Show rolls on here. It is a Turbo Tuesday edition of the program, and always pleased to welcome in David Murata, who is the president of Murata Wealth Management, online at muratonmoney.com, and a longtime guest on this program. Today, talking about systemic inequality in the Social Security rules and program. This is fascinating because, David, outside of you, I've never heard anybody bring this up. Welcome to the Shilling Show, and great to have you with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
All right, let's go to a brief history of Social Security. I'm guessing in the beginning that things were different than they are now.
So Social Security was enacted on August 14th, so we're coming up on the 86th anniversary of Social Security. And it was enacted as part of the New Deal under President Franklin Roosevelt. It was intended to solve a 34% non-agricultural unemployment that left older people destitute. So there was a particular time in the country, and it had a particular purpose. And you might say that purpose is long since gone by, and now Social Security is this legacy program that we have just hanging around. The program passed with 2% of the Democrats and 33% of the Republicans voting against it for different reasons. And back in the day, Social Security collected just 1% of wages and benefits. And that was because
there was
150 workers per retiree.
Oh, my goodness.
So
what a ratio.
I'm trying to get the exact exact stat there, but I think it was 150 workers per retiree. Yeah, 159.4 workers. Mm-hmm. By the 1975, that was down to 3.2. Today, it's even lower. But that's the problem that Social Security had. Back then, it could collect 1% of the wages, and it would have 159% of that wage to give to a retiree.
Yeah, this is really crazy because somebody could have foretold this. I mean, I just don't think they thought far enough advance. And I've got to ask you, looking back with perfect hindsight, with 2020 vision, let's just say you were in the situation that was occurring back at the time, 86 years ago. Is there another way that this could have been handled without these catastrophic illnesses? Have you ever pondered what you would have done instead?
Yes. So back then there were just, you know, work programs. Here's a project. Let's just put a bunch of people on it and get them done.
Right.
For the elderly, there wasn't a work program. And so they had a Social Security as well. I think it was, you know, the first Social Security beneficiary. We actually know who she was. And she lived to be over 100 and collect a lot more out of the system than she ever had given into it.
Yeah.
And that's part of the problem. Back then, I would have instituted two pieces. I would have instituted one piece, which was a welfare program for retirees who had never paid into the system.
Mm-hmm.
But I would have instituted another program, which would have been forcing people to pay for their own way in a private account. And I would have phased out the first, and I would have phased in the second. And that would have been pretty easy to do, because if you had started investing in 1935, you would have had fantastic returns for 30 years, so it would have been great.
Let's just say that this had started before the 1929 stock market crash. What would have been different? I mean, it seems like that was an anomaly, but I suppose it could happen again. Well, we've had bumps along the way, some of them serious. But how does that affect the whole equation of planning ahead for Social Security retirement?
Yeah, and the 1929 crash and more recently the 2008 financial crash are pointed to as a fact that the stock market is just too risky to be able to risk your retirement in. But in fact, that's what most of us do. And it's not too risky, because if you look at any 30-year time period, even the 1929 crash, you still have great returns. So over any 30-year time period, the market is going to have a return that averages about 6.5% over inflation. If you look at 2008, yes, 2008 went, you know, straight down. It was a four sigma event straight down for 6 months. And then it was a four sigma event straight up for 6 months. So if you looked from October to October, from October 1st of 2008 to October 1st of 2009, you could have had maybe 1 or 2% down in the markets over that time period. But if you'd ask people, well, how would you like to ride down halfway, you know, half your resources, and then come back up 48%, and how would that look? Then they would have been, well, that's a volatile ride. So the ride is always volatile in the stock market in the short term, but it is always, for longer term periods, the market gets less and less volatile, and it returns to, you know, a 6.5% over inflation. We like to say that you should have the next 7 years of spending in bonds, mm-hmm. and then you should have 8 years and beyond in stocks. And the reason for that is if you look at any high the market is making, and you look at how many times it will cross that new high, you know it's going to be once on the way up, and then down and up, there's three, and down and up, there's mm-hmm. five. So you know it'll be some odd number of times, and then it will land on the high side. But if you look at how many times it crosses, on average, it's 57 and takes 4.5 years. So that's why we like to say for 5 years, you need to have 5 years in bonds. Mm-hmm. Maybe 5 to 7 years is what we like to put in bonds. But if you look at 7 years, the average stock market return over a 7 year time period, the bottom of that is still positive. So over one standard deviation in the markets. So one standard deviation in the markets for 7 years goes from about 0.5% to about 14.5%. This is just stock market movement. It doesn't count dividends or interest or anything like that. So the stock market movement is positive for the bottom of one standard deviation is positive for 7 years and beyond. That's why we like to say 8 years and beyond really belongs in the market, mm-hmm. because your money should keep up with inflation, and inflation is now coming back. Inflation's running about 5.5% now.
Yeah, I heard a report this morning of almost 10% on Hugh Hewitt's program. I don't remember where that came from, but it is rearing its ugly head. David Morata, let's go to this concept of systemic inequality that you've noted here in this piece. And by the way, is this published already at MorataOnMoney.com?
It'll be published on Friday.
Okay, great. So people can look to it then, but go right ahead.
So systemic inequality is when systems within society predispose an unequal outcome, regardless of personal prejudice. So we're not trying to go to, you know, just people who say, I'm a racist, I don't like a particular group. But systemic inequality is these systems that predispose an unequal outcome. And the rules of Social Security are an example of systemic inequality. With full retirement age at age 67, this is for those born after 1960, the CDC reported full life expectancy at birth for Black or African American males at 72.2. Mm. So you retire at 67, you only get to collect benefits until 72 on average. That is a very short time period for Black males. Social Security is a system which transfers money from Black males to white females who never worked.
Yeah, this is super interesting. And again, I'm astounded that I haven't seen this in other places, but I'm so glad you brought it up. Before we go to the break, you mentioned the life expectancy for Black males is a little over 72. What is it for white males? Do you have that number?
I had it when I looked it up. It's white males and white females are both much higher than that. With white females being the highest.
Okay.
So I think it's like 85 and 88 is the numbers for
drastically different.
Yeah, and that's a much higher return. 85 and 88 are for retirement age. It's a little bit less than that for full life expectancy, which would be the comparison to do.
All right. We're coming back on the other side. 977-1070 is the phone number. Our final segment with David Morata. We'd love to hear from you. If you have comments or questions on systemic inequality in the Social Security system and rules, we're going to tell you more about it. It's just fascinating to consider this and what can, if anything, be done. Stay with us. All right. Schilling Show continues and into our final segment here. David Morata joins us, Morata Wealth Management, on systemic inequality in Social Security rules and system. All right, so we talked about the impact specifically on Black Americans, and we could extrapolate that that's impacting some other minorities as well. What if, I think you ran a scenario, or we could imagine if Black families, if they'd been able to save and invest as opposed to having their money taken from them and set aside in this way?
When you have 12.4% of your wages just taken away from you, and then normally, if you died young, that would be a financial legacy that you could leave to your family. And that financial legacy is what's being stolen from mostly Black households who mm-hmm. don't have longer life expectancies. And so that's part of the systemic inequality because they don't have that money left to them, whereas white folks have that money that they get throughout their entire lifetimes that they can then leave to their children. Liberals say that Social Security is too risky, but I've run the numbers, and Social Security is probably stealing your chance of being mm-hmm. a millionaire. Social Security is barely pulling people up out of poverty. But if you had $1.5 million or something along those lines, then you would be rich. And so that's the difference. Social Security is stealing your chance of being a millionaire simply because you would have paid maybe $260,000 in over a lifetime, and that would have grown and doubled and doubled and doubled again. And you could easily have a much greater salary simply by taking your retirement.
I got to ask your inner libertarian a question here, because I know that you have libertarian tendencies. We've talked about that before. But let's just go back to this example, the what if for black families. If they'd been able to save and invest, they would have been far better off. But the question is, and not just for black families, but the question is, would they have saved? The Social Security premise is that you will not save the money, that you don't have the self-control, and therefore you're going to be in trouble at the end of the line. And so I want to ask you about that and kind of trying to reconcile that with a libertarian perspective, because should people be compelled by the government to do something in this instance?
So the most dangerous form of power is coercive government power, because it forces you to do something no matter how bad the consequences are to you and your family. When you're empowered with voluntary choices, you have the tendency to decide for yourself what risks you want to take and you don't want to take. So I do believe that coercive government is the worst form of power, because regardless of what black families would have done, they would have either lived more fulfilling lives and not had all this money stolen from them by Social Security. They would have had more money to spend. They would have been able to do a lot of things that they couldn't do otherwise. And, you know, who is government to tell them that they have to put away this money and then they never get any of that money back? So that's kind of the worst form. A better form of coercion would have been privatized Social Security. So you have to put the money away. You can't get it until you're retired. And then you can't spend it too much in retirement. That would have been a better form of coercion. And then you would have allowed them to pick the investments that it's in and things like that. And there can be some limits around those investments. If you're looking for privatized Social Security, a lot of other countries have done this and have done this well. So Hong Kong, Australia, Switzerland, United Kingdom, Sweden, Netherlands, Denmark, Chile, and a host of others have done this and solved this problem. They know what works and what doesn't work. They have, you know, sort of tested these systems, and they know how to do it well. So I would simply look to other countries and say, how have other countries privatized their Social Security? And then I would move from a coercive social program to a coercive social savings network. And that would be a step up, because you would then have the ability to, for example, you would have the ability to put more money in the system if you wanted to, or less money, or things like that. And we do that now with retirement programs, and not all retirement programs, not all employers have retirement programs, so that's a problem. And when they do have a program, it's not done all that well, and there's not this personal choice of what you want to do. So I think there are ways of having personal choice with low fees and good returns and things like that built into the system that would be better than what the Social Security program does.
Yeah, this is something that I want to spend a little more time on, and we've got just a couple minutes left, but I think there needs to be immediate accountability. There was a program that was proposed a couple years back to our local congressman, and it was called Student Security, and it was allowing students to not make their loan payments in agreement for foregoing receiving Social Security way down the line, which, oh, that sounds like a great deal. But my comment on that was, as soon as you get that group of people hitting a critical mass, someone's going to say, those poor, poor people, they need to be taken care of, and everything, if not more, would be restored to them. It's just human nature. So it's almost like we could never have the ideal system. I guess we just have to take what's most accountable immediately and stick to it.
Yes. So you've correctly said that. The way that Social Security is currently working is, it's a myth that you put money in and somehow your money grows and then you get it back out again. So you put money in, and the money that you put in goes to fund your grandparents' and your parents' retirement. So that's the truth.
Yeah.
Is you put money in, and it's your grandparents' and parents' retirement. When you come, the question is not, am I going to get my benefits back out? Am I going to get my money back out? The question when you go to collect is, am I going to tax my children and my grandchildren to redistribute their income to my pocket? That's a very different equation, and that's what we're facing right now, except that we didn't pay enough in, and the current generation can't pay enough in to fund us, and so Social Security is going to be less solvent. Anything that would work to move this to privatization would be better, And my proposal would be something along the lines of, for privatizing Social Security, I would be willing to give up my benefits to means test it. So I don't need Social Security, but I'm going to collect it under the current system. I'm going to collect it, save it, and give it to my grandchildren. So if you don't want me to collect it, save it, and give it to my grandchildren, I would be willing to forego mine in order to have my grandchildren to be able to privatize the entire system. And that's politically where it is. Even past presidents have said, and the Supreme Court has said, these are not payments that you can be guaranteed of. These are simply a payroll tax on one side and a welfare program on the other side. You know, and it was, I think it was Al Gore who was trying to convince us that this was all some put in a lockbox somewhere, you know, and,
oh my
and trying to use all those images in his presidential debate. But that's simply not true. George W. Bush was the one who made a run at privatizing Social Security. And Social Security is called the third rail of politics because things like this don't tend to pass. But I think they could pass if you had the political will to do it and you had the equation that could satisfy both liberals and Democrats. I would take half of it and I would make it a Social Security system and I would beef up the benefits for those who can't afford it. And I would take the other half and make it privatized. And then I would means test Social Security. And if you means tested Social Security, maybe a third of it wouldn't, a third of us wouldn't get it. And it would be the upper third who really kind of don't need it. When we're calculating in our equations for can someone retire, if someone makes enough money, the Social Security is not going to be the difference of whether or not they can retire, because Social Security is going to be a very small amount of their assets.
David Morata is online at moradaonmoney.com. Always a great conversation. And this really, I do hope that you get some play here with this and that some of the policymakers will recognize the problems and go towards a rational solution. I'm just concerned that they'll just print some more money up and maybe they just hand money to certain people and they'll never, ever solve the problem. Thanks, David.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.